Winston and Volta are starting to look like the smart ones.
The colonel didn't expect an answer. I think he just needed a drinking buddy. I had a cognac from Sam's template. I was really getting used to the taste, and I just nodded. Truthfully, the raptor invasion hadn't resulted in any fatalities, and we were already starting on getting the fences fixed. Metal rods driven down 20 feet, spaced 6 inches apart, would take care of the digging issue. And Bridget, Dr. Sheehy, that is, had a device almost perfected that could detect parasite infection through body odor. No blood tests required, just wave your hand over it as you go by. Those would be installed in all building entrances as soon as she had all the, bugs out. Longer term, we hope to thin the parasites out to the point of eventual extinction. Meanwhile, she'd come up with a name for the thing, Cupid Bug, because, as she explained, it went for the heart. I had to admit I appreciated Bridget's sense of humor. I also had several small batches aging of something that might turn out to be a replacement for Jameson. Or for paint thinner. Time would tell. The colonel and I discussed a few miscellaneous items, but nothing really pressing. The council, as expected, had caved without a fight on the subject of Bronto burgers. Let's face it, one of the damn things would keep the entire colony in stakes for a couple of weeks. We wouldn't need to kill many. And the alternative was still kudzu. I said goodbye to the colonel and popped out. On a whim, I activated one of the surveillance drones. I took it up a couple of kilometers and did a slow pan. The sun was going down in the west, and it was a magnificent sight. From the surface of Vulcan, Omicron Squared Eridani appeared almost a third bigger than Earth's sun. As a K-type star, it had a slightly more orange cast, although you stopped noticing it after a day or so. But the additional output in the red end of the spectrum meant that even the most run-of-the-mill sunsets were spectacular by Earth standards. And today wasn't run-of-the-mill. Scattered clouds were all that were left of the recent thunderstorms, but those clouds glowed in the sky like individual wildfires. The forest-slash-jungle stretched horizon to horizon, hugging the hills and only reluctantly leaving the occasional rocky crag uncovered. Something like birds swooped and twirled in flocks that wouldn't have been seen on Earth since the days of the passenger pigeon. If you could ignore all the things with big shark teeth and the other things that could accidentally squish you between their toes, it was a kind of paradise. Oh, yeah, and the things that laid eggs in you. Ew! 30. Found something. Bashful. November 2187, Gliese, 877. We'd all taken off in different directions per Mario's orders. I picked GL-877, a nondescript star in a forgettable patch of sky. For all we knew, these others might not be planet-based or even system-based, but we had to start somewhere. At minimum, we'd be mapping their path of destruction.
We have radio traffic.
Guppy pushed a window toward me. As I examined the readings, my eyebrows climbed up my forehead. The radio noise coming from this system was clearly artificial. One way or the other, something intelligent lived here. Something noisy. Every possible caution, Guppy. Let's take it slow. I don't want to attract attention.
Understood.
And prep the stealth probes. I'd have been cautious anyway, but given the possibility that this was the others, I was going to give paranoia a brand new level of definition. I had spent my time during transit building a couple of stealth probes. I'd had to sacrifice some busters and some roamers, but the result was a couple of probes that would be almost undetectable unless they cranked up to full power. I had constructed them out of carbon fiber matrix ceramic and non-ferrous metal wherever possible. The others would have to be specifically looking for one of these in order to detect it. I'd already squirted the plans back to Mario as part of my continuous reporting. I was still going about 5% of light speed, so I lined up just below the ecliptic and released one probe. I altered my line slightly, then released the other. It would take just under 2 weeks for the probes to free fall through the system. Meanwhile, I would take a powered flight path, which would take me to the rendezvous point on the other side without my going anywhere near the inner system. Unless the residents had far better detection systems than we did, they'd never know I was here. I had carefully laid out parameters in which the probes would run for it and conditions in which they'd self-destruct. There would be no chances taken. In either case, once discovered, a probe would abandon attempts at stealth and squirt all telemetry to my calculated position. With my powered flight plan, I arrived at the rendezvous several days before the probes, on a vector straight outward from the system. The probes hit the brakes and activated their beacons as they came within range. I downloaded their data and transmitted the whole bundle in Mario's direction before beginning my own analysis. It took about 2 days to build a coherent picture of the inner system. There were two lonely inner rocky planets and a single small Jovian farther out. The inner of the two rocky planets appeared to have an atmosphere. The other had been too far away from either probe to get details, but it appeared to have a surprisingly high albedo. The system seemed to be particularly free of debris, except in an orbit about 80% of the orbital radius of the inner planet. At that distance from the sun, there was a truly spectacular amount of mass and activity spread right around the orbit. That whole area was, in fact, responsible for most of the electromagnetic activity in the system. I turned to Guppy and pointed at the mass concentration. What the crap is that?
Insufficient information, but we can rule out a natural satellite.
Not a planet?
Correct. The mass is too diffuse.
I wished I had someone besides Guppy to discuss this with. The plan had been to build a second wave of bobs back at Gliese 54 and send them to catch up with the first wave. So, within perhaps 6 months, I could be getting company. Hopefully the new bob had been picking up my transmissions and had a good idea of how to approach. I was sitting more than 6 billion kilometers from the local sun, in some of the emptiest space I could imagine. So it was a shock when the proximity alarms started sounding. I frame jacked up to maximum and started to evaluate the readings. Something was approaching at high speed, and the something apparently had a very well-shielded reactor because it was SUDAR that had picked it up. A quick set of calculations showed that I wouldn't be able to win a straight foot race. It or they were approaching too fast. It was time for our tried-and-true doubling-back tactic. I had no idea what their maneuverability was like, so I calculated a conservative option and began accelerating at a 35-degree angle to their approach vector. The other ships reacted almost immediately, which told me they had SUDAR detection capability. Light-speed limitations would have meant almost an hour's delay before they could respond to my movement. The tableau developed slowly over the next several hours. Like a game of chess, everything was on the table. There would be no surprise tactics. The laws of physics would decide if I got past them. However, it was already obvious that closest approach would be, well, pretty close. It took almost a day to reach that point. I spent the time scanning them with everything at my disposal. SUDAR and visuals confirmed 6 vessels, 5 very similar to the wrecked cargo ship, and one that honestly reminded me of a miniature Death Star. Miniature being a relative term, the thing was almost a 0.5 kilometer in diameter. Instead of an inset dish like the Star Wars prop, it had a flat section with what looked like a grid. I hoped the purpose wasn't similar. Finally, the laws of physics and reality made themselves clear, and I realized that I was going to sail past them less than 10 kilometers away. That was cutting it a little fine, but I'd take it. As I was nearing closest approach and getting ready to thumb my virtual nose at the pursuers, I saw the Death Star wannabe start to rotate, bringing the grid wall to bear on me. This is not good. Guppy, anything we can do about shielding?
All resources are at maximum.
I calculated that I could do a certain amount of jinking without losing my lead. I immediately started evasive maneuvers. However, the others had made the same calculations. The Death Star simply waited until I ran out of slack and zeroed in. The grid started to glow. Then there was a
alert, controller replicant offline. Surge drive offline. Requirements for self-destruct protocol have been met. Reactor overload engaged.
31. Taking care of business. Howard, January 2191, Vulcan. Riker was going to be video visiting our descendants in a few minutes. By tacit agreement, he was the face of Bob. We didn't want to confuse, or worse, creep out our sister's descendants. But all the Bobs tuned into the conversation whenever possible. It reminded us all that we used to be human, and that we had left our mark on the universe. Okay, our sisters had, but close enough. As usual, Julia was spokesperson for Clan Bob. People walked in and out of frame, stopped to make a comment or wave to the camera. The usual organized chaos, pretty much standard family stuff. Justin was a little older and no longer content to sit on his mother's lap. He kept running to get things to show Uncle Will. I grinned every time Justin was in frame. He was every Bob's favorite. Infinite energy, wide-eyed interest in anything and everything, and no idea at all what a scary and dangerous post-apocalyptic universe he'd been born into.
"You'll have three new great-greats soon, Will,"
Julia smiled happily.
"There's so much room here. It's a complete reversal of how we felt back on Earth. It doesn't feel like a sin to have children anymore."
Will laughed. "We are sending more people your way, Julia, but even if we settled every last remaining human being on Romulus, it still wouldn't be crowded. You have a new world and a new start." Justin pouted into the camera.
"But we don't have dinosaurs. I want dinosaurs."
"Sorry, Space Cadet," Will replied. "They're only on Vulcan. When you're older and have your own ship, you can visit and see them."
"If any are left," said one of the others, sotto voce.
Julia turned and glared at him, and he blushed. "Howard tells me that the USE colonists are being careful about environmental impacts," Will said, trying to diffuse the moment of tension. "I understand that the Spitz and Faith are supposed to be doing the same."
"Not from what I can see," the man said.
"Richard is kind of a crank about the subject,"
Julia said, looking slightly embarrassed.
"Don't let him get up ahead of steam."
At that moment, I received a text from Riker. "Is there a big problem with this?" He'd frame-jacked to send the text, so I did the same as I replied. "Faith is constantly pushing their luck. I've had several run-ins with Cranston about this and that. Richard's comment doesn't really surprise me. I'll look into it." On camera, Will said to the group, "Howard is watching for that kind of thing, Richard. He'll nip it in the bud. The enclaves sign an agreement before we emigrate them, dealing with stuff like human rights and planetary exploitation." Richard nodded, and the conversation drifted to other subjects. It was over too soon, but the videos were archived and got a lot of plays on BobTube. The thing about the Faith colony bugged me, though. Cranston was really turning into a pain. 16 surveillance drones lifted smoothly from their cradles and flew off to take up positions around landing. I looked over at Guppy. "Everything in the green?"
"No issues detected. All parameters nominal."
The Amy controlling the surveillance system was an artificial machine intelligence Guppy hybrid based on Bob's work at Delta Eridani. It would combine the fast reflexes and multitasking of a true AI with the decision-making capability of a replicant. Plus, it would never get bored or demand vacation time. This was one more item that I wouldn't be needed for anymore. The to-do list was finally getting smaller faster than I could add to it. Excellent! Okay, then, we'll let it run for a couple of days to establish processor loads, then we'll add the Cupid bug hunters to the system.
The hunters are autonomous units.
That was true. Given the highly focused nature of their task, Amy's were intelligent enough for Cupid bug hunter operation. Granted, but the central controller can take care of scheduling, maintenance, and repairs, as well as gathering statistics. I'm sure Bridget would like to know if encounters start to drop off. Guppy nodded. I'm sure the expression of sardonic amusement on his face was all in my imagination. After all, what does sardonic amusement look like on a fish, anyway? And speaking of Bridget, Dr. Sheehy, I had a call to make. There was a small matter of a chemical analysis that I'd asked for.
Sheehy.
Bridget briefly appeared in the video window, then exited frame to the left. The woman never stayed still, and always seemed to be working on several things at once. I couldn't help be impressed by her energy. "Hey, Bridget, it's Howard." Dr. Sheehy's face lit up as she came back into frame and sat down in front of the phone. We'd become fast friends over the last 6 months. We got along well, and she was a good break from too many Bobs. I tried not to think ephemeral when she was around.
"I guess you're calling about that chemical analysis you wanted done?"
Yep.
Well, you'll be happy to know that it passes muster and cleanly. No trace of methanol. It is completely potable.
She grinned.
Now, whether it's any good or not...
Bridget reached over and picked up the bottle that I'd delivered the previous day. She poured a small amount into a plastic glass and raised it in my direction.
Kirika.
She downed the glass in one motion. I watched closely, waiting for her to go rigid, or melt, or burst into flames. She swallowed the liquid, took a deep, sucking breath, wiped her eyes, and said,
Smooth.
Really?
No.
Bridget made a face.
It's not paint thinner, but it's not Irish whiskey either. Actually, since you used oak barrels, it'll never be Irish, but if you squint your eyes and look sideways at it while yelling la la la, it could be whiskey.
I nodded. Well, I force-aged this stuff, so let's not expect miracles. I'll take a little more time with the production supply, and Riker thinks he can scan some proper sherry-infused barrel samples for me for making Irish.
Sounds good.
Bridget gave me a sideways look.
Need a partner?
Well, someone has to hump the barrels around. I grinned at her. But yeah, it would help, if you're serious. Anyway, I was also calling about the Peter project.
Right. Well, Peter and his descendants are munching happily on the vine, turning it into more bunnies as quickly as they can. Farmers are happy, bunnies are happy, raptors are happy. Not surprisingly, they like bunny as well. Pretty much a win-win for everyone, except the vine.
Great, I nodded, then popped up a picture on the video screen. In other news, I've come up with a small drone that's optimized for hunting the adult parasite. You said you didn't think killing it would be too disruptive, right?
Correct, oh, electronic one. It's an apex predator, really. There may be a population explosion in whatever it normally uses as hosts, but my guess is that there are normal-sized predators who will take care of that.
Hmm, good. I'll be adding them to the central surveillance system. I'll need an estimate from you of how many we should have active at any time. Bridget nodded without comment. She was eyeing the paint thinner, twirling the glass in her hand. Hopefully she was considering another shot and not fearing for her health. I asked her, what does Cahiraca mean?
Cahiraca. It's Irish for chairs.
Chairs. You toast furniture in Ireland? Bridget laughed.
There's a story, probably apocryphal.
I made a rolling motion with my hand.
Okay, but remember, you asked.
She settled herself and poured another glass of paint thinner.
There was this Brit who decided to stop at Hotel Rosslare in County Wexford. He had a few, then a few more. Then he decided to be friendly, so he asked the barmaid how you say cheers in Irish.
Bridget smiled wickedly.
And you know how the Brits massacre the English language, so she thought he said chairs, and she told him, whereupon he bought a round for the house, turned to the other patrons, raised his glass, and said, Catirica.
I chuckled. Bridget gave me the stink eye.
Hey, down in front. Anyway, the other patrons looked at each other in confusion, then raised their glasses and drank. Afterwards, Paddy turned to Sean and said, What the places was that? Sean shrugged and answered, Damned if I know, but as long as he keeps buying, he can toast the livestock for all of me.
I laughed. I know some Irish jokes.
Don't you dare.
She grinned at me, and I had a sudden feeling of regret at no longer being human. Stefan, this is Bridget. Bridget? Stefan. Stefan held out his hand, and Bridget shook it. They both turned to look at me. Well, at the drone I was watching from. The new model was slightly bigger than a softball, so could go indoors. I was told my voice sounded a little tinny, but I could survive that. I lowered myself to conversation height, and they sat. I'd texted our order to the waiter, so beers arrived immediately.
So, is there an occasion for this?
Bridget looked back and forth between me and Stefan. Not really. I mean, I'm not planning a takeover of the colony or anything. God, why would I want to? I chuckled. One of Stefan's eyes twitched, so I guess a tinny chuckle didn't come across well. Anyway, between the Brontos and other dinos, the raptors, vine, cupid bug, and everything else that makes this such a fun place to live, I spend most of my time coordinating with the two of you. The committee seems determined to funnel all information through themselves, and sometimes I just want to slap them. So you are creating unofficial channels here? A slow grin spread across Stefan's face.
Something like that. You know, just to speed things along.
Stefan looked at Bridget. You are responsible for the rabbits? Nice choice. I've had rabbit stew several times this month.
Bridget laughed and turned to me.
Told you.
She flipped open her tablet and set it up on a corner of the table, then looked at the drone and inclined her head towards the tablet. I took the hint, floated the drone up to the ceiling, and transferred my image to the tablet. This better? Both of my friends grinned at the tablet. Stefan said,
You're still ugly.
It was a great afternoon. 32. Linus. Bill. May 2178, Epsilon Eridani.
Incoming message from Linus.
Linus? Holy hell, put it on. I just recently received the radio transmission from Linus about Epsilon Indy and KKP. Linus had, unfortunately, left Epsilon Indy before my transmissions of the Scut plans had reached him. He'd been out of touch since 2150 when he left Epsilon Indy, and he hadn't lagged his light-speed report by more than a few months. I smiled to myself. There would have to be some catching up. Linus's original transmission included a complete description of his encounter with Henry Roberts, the replicant from the Australian probe, which officially didn't exist. Guppy popped up an email for me. It was a status update, essentially. Linus was still a few days away, and he hadn't been getting VR updates for the last 30-odd years. The old video connections were even more subject to Tau-related limitations than modern VR. I sent him a return email with VR updates attached. Meanwhile, I would start building a Scut unit for him to install when he got here. Linus sat back, coffee in hand, and put his feet up on the desk. I raised an eyebrow at him.
Come on, Bill, Linus said, laughing. I'll fix any virtual damage afterwards, okay?
I grinned back. Mom taught us better than that. Linus rolled his eyes and took his feet off the desk. He materialized a footstool and made himself comfortable. Gotta admit, I really like the new VR system. Nice job. Wasn't just me, Linus. Everyone has put in mods. Bob One did a whole independent branch out at Delta Eridani before we reconnected. Some really good fine detail stuff came out of that. Linus shifted to get more comfortable, and I grinned into the short silence. Okay, before I explode, what's with KKP? You've actually named it Clown Car Planet?
Yep,
Linus grinned back at me.
Have you seen the orbital mechanics diagram? It's a satellite of the system's Jovian, and both the orbit and the planet's axis are inclined 90 degrees from normal. Try to visualize the path of the sun over the year.
Habitable?
Technically. Air's right, gravity's right. Life is biocompatible, but I wouldn't want to live there.
On the other hand, we don't have a surplus of colony targets. I'll bet one of the enclaves will select it.
Linus nodded. He took on an introspective expression, and I knew he wanted to talk about Henry.
I waited for him to organize his thoughts.
So, Bill, I've been doing some work with Henry. You've gone over my reports, right?
Without a VR, he went psychotic and started following a warped version of his directives. You extracted his matrix from the structure you found and set up a VR for him, then started some homebrew therapy.
Linus nodded. I've gotten him to the point where he understands what happened. He's living in reality now, but he's still pretty fragile. He can go into panic attacks without warning. When that happens, he goes back to his sailboat.
Okay, so what sets him off?
He's agoraphobic, which seems strange since he has no problem being in a teeny boat in the middle of an ocean.
Linus rolled his eyes.
And he doesn't like Guppy. Apparently the Australians used the same acronym for the Guppy interface as Faith did.
It's the other way around, Linus. I'll bring you up to date later. But Australia actually got there first. Anyway, continue.
Linus gave me a perplexed look, but apparently decided to go along with my schedule.
So the imaginary beings that tortured him were fish. I've been trying to desensitize him to Guppy's presence.
It helps that we use the Akbar image. He saw Star Wars, and he thinks that's pretty funny. I took a moment to shake my head. Incredible. 100 years after Star Wars and Star Trek were made, people were still watching them. Linus shrugged. They were still playing The Wizard of Oz, the Judy Garland version, when original Bob was an adult. That's 75 years. How is it different? I waved a hand to concede the point. So you've upgraded Henry's VR and hardware, right? Let's bring him in. Linus nodded and froze for a moment. Then, as his avatar came back to life, another person popped in. This wasn't a Bob. Henry was shorter, with a trim, healthy physique and thin, dark hair. I had an actual moment of vertigo. It had been so long since I'd been in the presence of anyone except variations of Bob. It was different from video conferences with humans. VR or not, Henry was here. I took a moment to catch my breath, then extended a hand. Hi, Henry. Welcome to the Bobiverse. The what? Linus and Henry both spoke at once, their eyes goggling in tandem. Long story, I laughed. Look, Henry, I've given you your own domain and your own firewall. It's a mutual protection thing, but you'll have access to all the public features of BobNet, which includes several blogs. You should start reading. You too, Linus. You're way behind the times. Jeeves came in at my summons and offered Henry a coffee. Henry did a double take and pointed. That's, I grinned. John Cleese. Yep. I looked at Linus. You don't use Jeeves? Linus shook his head. Doesn't really fit my VR. Meanwhile, Henry had taken the coffee, grinning. Got anything to strengthen it? He asked. I nodded to Jeeves, who produced a bottle of whiskey out of nowhere. A quick pour, and Henry was looking much happier. I understand intellectually that this is all virtual reality. Henry sat down and gestured around him. But it's quite amazing. If I didn't already know, I think I'd be completely fooled. He turned to Linus. No offense, Linus, but your VR had some issues, if I were paying attention. Linus waved a hand in dismissal. Henry? Bill and others have been working on the tech for 30 years while I've been gone. It shouldn't be surprising. Okay. I have some reading to do. Acknowledged. How many people can you fit into a single virtual reality session? It depends on the power of the computer that's hosting it, Henry. I've got a huge system here in Epsilon Eridani that's specifically designed for hosting. I've hosted baseball games and Bob moots with dozens of Bobs at a time. I glanced at each of them in turn. You guys both have some catching up to do. Linus, I've started building a latest generation vessel for each of you. Henry, it's up to you what you want to do. I understand you have some sensitivities that you're dealing with. There's no hurry. We have, literally, all the time in the universe. Henry looked shocked. Perhaps it hadn't really hit him before. As replicants, we were immortal. Some of the later generation Bobs had started to refer to humans as ephemerals. I wasn't going to lecture anyone, but I believed the tag was dismissive and dehumanizing. I sat forward and put my coffee down. Henry, I'd love to see your boat when you have time and feel up to it. As you could probably tell from Linus, we've never had any experience with sailing. Meanwhile, let's get started on bringing you guys up to date. Henry nodded and smiled tentatively. Linus made a head motion to him, and they disappeared. I could hardly wait for the next moot. 33. Trouble in Paradise. Bob, January 2180, Delta Eridani. Buster had taken a mate. Archimedes and he were working on a framework for a tent while the women stitched together the covering. Tents now covered the ground in downtown Camelot, and I was starting to see some variations in design. Archimedes had started to rebuild his for the third time, a process that was making Diana cranky. I rarely saw eye to eye with her, but in this case I could see her point. It was a peaceful, bucolic scene, except for all the armed Deltans walking around. Deltans had always been armed, of course, but in the past the weapons had been for hunting or for protection against predators like the gorilloids. But in the last year or two, there had been incidents of violence between Deltans. Marvin and I sat in the middle of the village VR watching the activity. The VR was now a completely real-time representation of activity in Camelot, with only one or two blind spots where I hadn't been able to sneak in a camera. Marvin waved his glass of cognac in the general direction of a group of young Deltans. He'd picked up the habit from Howard over at Vulcan, and I still got a kick out of it. "So, Camelot has street gangs now," he said. "Are they going around hot-wiring teepees?" I responded with an eye roll and an exaggerated nod, then answered, "This is pretty recent behavior. I think it might have something to do with population density. They're getting too crowded, and the tents take up more space, which just makes it worse." "Everything has side effects," Marvin said with a smile. "Have you noticed the gangs are co-ed?" "Yeah. I'm sure a sociologist would have something to say about that, but the libraries don't have much in the way of that particular discipline." Marvin snorted. "Doesn't strike me as a field of study that theists would approve of, you know?" I nodded. "Too bad, though. The last mating season was significantly more violent. Two Deltans ended up dying from injuries, and now we're getting face-offs between the Hexki. It worries me." "You could busterize someone." "Not funny, Marv." Marvin shrugged. He knew that I'd been staying strictly out of sight since my banishment. I couldn't take the chance of fallout from a Bob sighting affecting Archimedes. After a moment, he added, "On the other hand, Bob, the problems we're seeing are a result of the Deltan population going up. As problems go, it's a hell of a lot better than the problem you first found them with." I smiled, as much at Marvin's transparent attempt to make me feel better as anything. But he was right. When I found the Deltans, attrition had been slowly killing them off. A rising population was infinitely better, for all the issues it was causing. "So, what do we do?" "Nothing. At least for the moment. I'm banished, remember?" I shrugged. "I suppose this is that point where I step away and let the Deltans make their own destiny. I talked about it in the past, but I guess I always expected it to be my choice, not forced on me." I gave Marvin a lopsided grin, and he laughed. "I'm sure most parents feel that way at some point." 34. Moose. Bill. June 2185, Epsilon Eridani. I could feel the wind on my face as I ran. This was nothing like VR. I controlled Bullwinkle directly. Well, sort of, as he ran over the surface of Ragnarok. I was easily holding 70 kph, the android's reflexes taking care of the limb coordination at that speed. The system was still far from perfect. In order to make this work, I had two drones following the moose. Radio comms between Bullwinkle and the drones were relayed via Scut to me. It was more a proof of concept than a practical solution. But ignoring the Rube Goldberg communications, I now had a physical presence on the surface of the planet. I slowed down as I approached my target coordinates. As I jogged up to the patch of green, I marveled at the smooth feel of the muscles working under the skin. It occurred to me that the VR experience was missing this level of detail. I'd have to correct that. The VR was coming due for a patch release anyway. I stopped at the edge of the green. I engaged close-up visual and examined the moss-lichen mix. It had taken some brutally heartless breeding to come up with a mix that could survive in this atmosphere. I'd probably had less than a 1% survival rate on each generation for a while. But the result, in front of me, was justification for all the effort. The green area was taking in CO2 and putting out oxygen. Only during the day, granted, but I'd bred it to go into a deep dormancy at night, so it used up virtually no oxygen. The green could double in size every year, given enough available space, and I'd been careful to give the individual plantings enough room to grow. I would continue to start new plantings as well, so within 10 years I expected to have half the global land surface covered. And within a decade after that, I should have an oxygen level that humans could tolerate. There were still problems with the atmosphere. Too much CO2, not enough nitrogen, far too much methane and other organics, but I had projects on the go to ameliorate those issues as well. I had recently seeded some of the seas with different forms of photosynthetic algae.
I regretted that these imports would easily outcompete the native life that was just beginning to get a grip, but I knew that it wouldn't have survived the introduction of Terran sea life anyway. Humanity was still drastically short of available new colonization targets, and that really was my number one priority. Within another 50 years, I would have a planet people could walk around on without protection. It was good. Meanwhile, Bullwinkle had the place to himself, the only quadruped on an empty planet. The seas hadn't yet connected into oceans, although I wasn't more than a couple of years away from that. Until then, I could go anywhere on foot. Hoof. I picked my next inspection site and hit the gas.
Okay, that was damned cool. Garfield closed the recording of the Moose session. Can I try it?
That's a little personal, don't you think? You should build your own. Doesn't have to be a moose either.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, Bill. Why wouldn't you just go for a human analog? Isn't that the point?
I waved a hand in the general direction of the video window.
Sure, but trying to handle bipedalism would have just cranked up the feedback requirements by an order of magnitude while reducing the available space for processing hardware. I'll get there, don't you doubt it.
Garfield nodded and rubbed his chin and thought,
I've always wanted to fly.
10 new Bobs sat around the table, nursing whatever drink they'd ordered. I was now using the pub as my standard VR. I'd gotten tired of the park, and especially the stupid geese. I raised a glass to them. Here's to taking 82 Aridini back.
Back? Loki grinned at me. Did we ever actually have it?
Just roll with it, Loki. This is rhetoric. It doesn't have to make sense. There were chuckles, and the Bobs raised their glasses in response.
These Bobs were to be the second strike force for 82 Aridini. Our first attempt had ended up more or less as a draw. We'd killed all the Madiri in that system as far as we knew, but with only Khan left alive, we couldn't hold this system against the automated weaponry. This time, two of the members of the attack force would drive cargo vessels. I'd loaded up a number of innovations and a crap ton of extra busters. There would be no issue of being outnumbered this time around. It wasn't just a pride thing. Milo had identified not one, but two habitable planets before he was torpedoed. Medeiros, left to himself, would garrison the system in preparation for colonists from a country that didn't exist anymore. We needed to take it back. At Khan's request, I had loaded his backup into one of the fresh matrices. It seemed this particular branch of the Bob tree liked villains because he'd immediately named himself Loki. I looked forward to the shenanigans the next time Thor showed up to a Bob moot. I had also loaded Elmer's backup into one of the new vessels. His first words were the standard Pacinoism. I could sympathize, I guess. Like Tom Cruise, you keep going back in until you win. We talked for a while, knocked back a few more, then it was time to go. They said their goodbyes, popped into their own group VR, and started the journey to 82 Aridini. To clean house. I raised my arm above my head and pressed the button. Instead of the usual annoying blat, the air horn produced a Dixie melody. The crowd of Bobs, who had been preparing to boo me, instead broke into laughter. I grinned to the crowd.
Just keeping you on your toes. So, announcements first. I'm sure you've heard about Linus and Henry Roberts. Well, Henry is feeling ready to mingle today, so Linus is going to bring him over. Try to be polite, okay?
People responded with catcalls and witticisms while I sent a quick ping to Linus. A moment later, he popped into the moot, with Henry beside him. The effect was immediate. Total silence, as every Bob in the room stared. I grinned at the sight. I knew the feeling from my first meeting with Henry. We could all tell each other apart because of metadata tags, but other than some variations on facial hair, we'd all kept the original features. This was a different face, a non-Bob face. Henry looked around.
Well, this is awkward.
It was the right thing to say. Everyone laughed, then stepped forward to say hello. I was worried for a moment that Henry would get a panic attack, but he held up. I gave it a few milliseconds, then brought everyone back to order with a short blap from the air horn.
The other major item, for those who haven't already heard, is that the second 82 Eridani expedition with Loki leading has shipped out. We are on our way to kick some Medeiros butt. When the cheering had died down, I continued. And the last item is to remind you about the regular scrub baseball games. Come one, come all. You all know why I'm doing this. It's up to you whether you want to participate.
I turned and glared at Garfield.
And for the anonymous troll who put a call for a hockey league on today's agenda, no! Garfield grinned back at me as the crowd broke up in laughter. 35. Sales call. Howard, September 2192, Vulcan. Bridget and I watched as Butterworth took a careful sip. He held the glass away from his face and looked at it. Damn, he had one of the best poker faces I'd ever seen, and possibly a cast-iron throat. He might as well have been drinking water for all the reaction he showed.
Well?
Bridget leaned forward. I took a second to grin at her impatience. For me, this was an interesting project and a chance to do a favor for the colonel. For Bridget, this was an actual potential source of extra income. We Bobs might not have a use for capitalism, but in the human realm, money still made the world go around. Butterworth glanced at Bridget and then looked at me in the video screen.
It's actually not bad. It's definitely Irish whiskey. And since the Jameson has run out, I've been feeling the lack.
So this would be a saleable item?
Bridget hovered like a dog waiting for a treat.
Absolutely. You know we've already got several beer manufacturers and a couple of small wineries going. This is the first hard liquor, though, that doesn't qualify as a public hazard.
Bridget turned toward my image on the table and grinned. Looked like we were in business. Butterworth waved the empty glass.
If I wasn't in a position where it would create a perceived conflict, I'd suggest partnering up. However, I guess I will have to settle for being a customer.
Bridget took the hint and refilled his glass, then hers. I popped up a cognac and raised it in a toast. Bridget started to laugh with her mouth full, then had to grab a napkin. We were having dinner at The Shaded Green, one of the better restaurants in Landing. Okay, one of the only restaurants in Landing. And by we, I mean her. I was looking out through her tablet, which was propped up on the other end of the table. I'd set up a matching virtual meal of my own. Not bad, actually. Turned out I could cook.
So Cranston out and out forbade you to sell liquor into Faith territory?
She rolled her eyes and put down the napkin. Yep. It seems the ultra-religious don't approve of strong drink. Who knew?
So we have to write off that entire market?
I gave her a disbelieving look. Of course not. We just have to find a local distributor. Prohibition has never worked. Anywhere. I grinned. And strangely, there's always demand.
How's the potato crop coming along?
Bridget took a bite of her Bronto steak and leaned forward on her elbows. Well, I've been growing potatoes for more than a year now. I waved a hand dismissively. This crop is only different in that it's not part of the commons. And it's going fine. We'll have vodka for sale within 6 months.
I've always wanted to be a bad influence.
Bridget laughed.
Now I'm a liquor baron. Baroness.
I raised my glass to her. In honor of the occasion, I was drinking virtual whiskey instead of cognac.
Here's to us, kid.
Bridget raised her own glass and drank. She put it down and said,
So you never answered my question.
Which?
Is this a business dinner or a date?
Yes. She smiled back at me. Damn, that was some smile.
36. Asteroid Movers. Bill, March 2187, Epsilon Eridani.
I'm feeling pretty smug right now, I grinned at Garfield. He tried for maybe a millisecond to look unimpressed, but no one was fooled. Right there in front of us, the asteroid mover was altering the approach vector of one of our icebergs. The difference in this case was that no part of the mover was touching the berg. The mover segments were spaced evenly around the center of gravity of the asteroid, held in place by individual surge drives, and the assembly as a whole generated another surge field that affected the entire asteroid. The interactions were complex, and we'd had a few experimental failures, but this one had passed all tests, and today was the first live field trial. Everything was well within specs, and the changing path of the Berg was right in the groove. Finally, Garfield said, "And done. Shut down." "Excellent. Wait 60 seconds to make sure there's no drift, then collect the drive segments." Garfield nodded to me. A minute later, 20 individual saucer-shaped drive segments left their self-imposed positions around the Berg, linked up like a stack of plates, and went to station keeping relative to Gar and myself. In the video window, the Berg fell neatly into an approach that would skim the atmosphere of Ragnarok. At the proper moment, a series of explosions would convert it to ice cubes, which would all melt and fall as rain over the next few weeks. Textbook. I looked down at the large crater on Ragnarok, which served as a permanent reminder of the iceberg that I'd missed. Yep, a lot of energy stored up in a chunk of matter coming in at orbital speeds, and being ice instead of rock hadn't helped as much as you'd expect. A new sea was slowly forming in the crater, which I had named Bullseye. 37. He's gone. Riker. August 2176. Sol.
Homer's gone.
Charles popped into my VR, tears in his eyes. Gone where? Left the system?
No. Gone. Dead. He overloaded his reactor and blew himself up.
Charles had both hands clamped into fists. He couldn't lift his eyes to look at me. How old is his most recent back?
He deleted all his backups, every single one. He left a file for us.
Charles pushed it toward me and turned away.
Guys, I'm sorry to do this to you. I know how it'll go over. But I can't live with what was done to me and with what I've done. I have flashbacks constantly. I can't forget the feeling of being controlled. It was like being able to feel a tapeworm moving around inside you, and there's nothing you can do. I'd edit the memory out if it was possible, but it's not. Please, find the people who are responsible and drop something on them. Homer. I looked at Charles. He was shaking and biting back sobs. Then he blurred as my eyes filled. We would grant Homer's last wish, and it would be no trouble at all.
38. Following up. Hal. May 2188, Gliese 877. I was 10 months from Gliese 877 when I received Bashful's final radio transmission. Effectively, I had just watched myself die. It was a freaky feeling, not something I cared to repeat. How had Bashful been traced? One possibility was that the others had intercepted his transmissions, since those would have passed through the system once he was on the far side. Between the encryption we put on all our comms and the lack of any format information, I wasn't worried about them learning anything, but simply detecting the transmissions wasn't too much of a stretch. I was more concerned about me joining Bashful as the main course. It wouldn't take much intelligence to decide to follow the direction of the transmission, if that was what they keyed on. In that case, there might be an alien armada coming straight down my throat. With that thought, I immediately instituted a hard right turn at 10G. As soon as I was a few light minutes off the straight line between Gliese 877 and Gliese 54, I fired off a drone along my original vector. At the speed I was still going, the drone wouldn't need to use its drive. It could operate on minimal systems, drawing just enough power to maintain a master link with me. I wanted to know if anything was coming. I also fired off some commentary and analysis of the situation back to Mario via Scut. We had to plan for the possibility of them tracing Bashful back to his origin. In principle, if the others got hold of a space station, they could eventually trace the connection all the way back to Epsilon Eridani.
And if they found one that had been upgraded to Scut, they'd have that too. If Mario was still back there, manning the station, I suggested that he booby-trap it. I sat back in my easy chair and looked out the window, lost in thought. The floor-to-ceiling glass showed a winter scene unbroken by anything man-made. Tall evergreens in the foreground gradually dropped into a tree-filled valley. Snowflakes blurred the view into the distance, while lending a postcard feel to the foreground. In a small breach of reality, my VR world never filled with snow, despite never having spring melts. But hey, what's the point of obsessive realism? I let myself get about 30 light minutes off the line before turning back toward Gliese 877. The drone would let me know if something approached along my original vector, unless there was a collision, which frankly would be just fine. The combined kinetic energy of two masses, each going about 0.75c or so in opposite directions, would produce a truly impressive light show. I sighed and turned to Guppy. Analysis?
Too many unknowns. If the alien Sudar has greater range than ours, they may destroy the drone before it gets close enough to register their approach. Or it may not be big enough to register or to bother with. Or they may not be interested enough to investigate.
That's about what I was thinking. The others don't seem to care a lot about other species, or ecosystems, or civilizations. They may actually be very Borg-like in ignoring us until it suits them. Guppy didn't comment. Version 3 memory capacity or not, he still wasn't into small talk. It took a month to close the distance to Gliese 877. I was sure Bashful had thought he was being cautious, but I was 10 times more so. I fired off several probes with orders to rendezvous at coordinates 2 light hours away from where I'd be waiting. They'd sit there for a week while I watched for any reaction. Only then would I collect them. Things went pretty much according to plan. Mostly. I got to my planned location and waited for the probes to gather at their location. Right on schedule, they coasted up and came to a stop. I transferred all their data over and settled down for a week of waiting. I got through 2 days' worth before a flotilla of others showed up on the probe's Sudar. As hoped, the others were too far to detect me or for me to detect them directly.
Same conformation as last time.
Yeah, they seem to be consistent that way. Any indication they've detected us?
Negative. Trajectories are focused on the probes.
Okay, then, blow the probes and let's get out of here.
Aye. Probe destruction directive sent. Will we wait for Sudar confirmation?
Yes, but if the others show any inclination at all to change course, we're out of here. Right at the expected time, the probes disappeared from Sudar. We turned and put some distance behind us at full 10G. After I squirted a status report and all the raw telemetry Mario word, I combed through the data myself. We continued to accelerate away from Gliese 877, although I was planning on looping around and approaching from Stellar North for another round of spying. In the holotank, a picture slowly formed of the inner system. The first interesting tidbit was the outer rocky planet. Will you look at that? I leaned back in my chair and shook my head in disbelief. Even Guppy looked impressed. I think. Really hard to tell with a fish.
The planet is completely encased in metal.
Or is completely made of metal. Do we actually know if there's a planet underneath that?
The engineering for an artificial structure all the way down would be impressive.
I experienced a jolt of irritation. I was the engineer and Guppy had just handed me my ass. He was right, of course. A completely metal planet all the way to the core would require some truly astonishing engineering. A totally encased planet, maybe with a lot of underground structures, would make a lot more sense. The problem was, we didn't really know for sure. And I was beginning to think that astounding engineering might be exactly what we could expect from the others. I turned to the main event on the display. That is what I think it is, right?
Based on what we can detect, it appears to be the beginning of a Dyson sphere.
Yep. Truly astonishing. The orbit just to the inside of the inner planet was crazy busy. Fusion signatures, radio traffic, Sudar emissions, and high albedo craft flitting around. And that was just the small stuff. Floating in orbit, spaced equidistantly around the sun, were massive structures. Analysis indicated that they conformed to a spherical curvature with the same radius as their orbit. They were, essentially, the beginning of a globe around the star. Well, we know where the metal went. We can guess where the... I couldn't finish the thought. Any idea of population based on what we have?
Impossible to estimate without more information on subject biology.
Fair enough. I turned to the other terrestrial planet in the system. Atmosphere blocked a lot of direct observation, but infrared and spectroscopic analysis indicated generally breathable air, though with a lot of pollutants, and the temperature would be close to fatal for a human. My guess is that's the home planet, and they global warmed themselves almost to extinction before getting into space.
Reasonable.
Out of idle curiosity, I started putting together a simulation to predict how they would assemble the Dyson sphere, how long it would take, and how many systems they'd have to plunder. I had to make a lot of assumptions, but I needed to start somewhere. I was immersed in the problem when I was interrupted by Guppy.
Alert! Proximity alert! Incoming!
You've got to be freaking kidding me. How are they detecting us? I'm not even using radio. In one sense, that was a good thing, since it would mean they didn't have any idea which direction we were coming from. In another sense, I was being chased, which was much less of a good thing. I spared a few milliseconds to review the Sudar results. Our improved Sudar, courtesy of Bill, had given me an earlier warning of the approaching enemy. Again, the same formation as the two previous occasions. Well, they were consistent anyway. They were coming up from behind, so there was no opportunity for our traditional trick. This was going to be a straight-out stern chase, which meant I would find out who had the better legs. I immediately sent an update to Mario via Scut. I also started on a baseline backup as well, with plans to add periodic differential backups. All of this analysis and planning took perhaps 20 milliseconds. I turned my ship away from Gliese 877 and cranked the surge drive up to maximum. Interestingly, the others did not react immediately. There was a half-hour delay before I saw them change their course. That was too quick for a visual reaction, so it meant that I had a 30-light-minute advantage in Sudar range. Unfortunately, I seemed to be about 2.5 Gs outmatched in the surge department. Pings indicated that they were accelerating at 12.5 G on my tail. I was going to lose the foot race. I briefly considered using the Sudar jamming, then mentally slapped myself. Jamming wasn't like cloaking. It was like blinding everyone with a searchlight. They'd be able to follow the emission like a beacon. My only advantage was the apparent difference in range between my Sudar and theirs. If I could keep myself in that range long enough, I might be able to jink out of their view entirely. Over the next several days, I changed my vector at random times, in random directions, but always with the intention of extending my lead. The others kept cutting the distance. Then I'd pull a fast one and extend it. I was subtly training them to expect certain behaviors from me, and I watched for them to start anticipating my moves. Finally, they were doing exactly what I expected of them. I made a predictable turn, then as soon as I judged myself to be out of range, I turned to an unexpected vector and shut down all systems. By my calculations, I'd stay out of Sudar range as they passed by. With no reactor signature, I should be invisible since I was certainly too far away for a visual. I coasted for 3 days, unwilling to take a chance of attracting their attention. There was a good chance that they were quartering the area, trying to reacquire my trail, but given the immensity of space and the speeds we had been traveling, for every second that passed, the volume that they had to search expanded faster than they could search it.
On the fourth day, I bundled up all my observations and data, added a differential backup, and squirted it off to Mario.
There was something about the whole thing that nagged at the edge of my mind, though. The timing of the appearance of the others' patrol groups wasn't consistent with following or chasing the probes. It was
more as though they spotted them and came running, but not before the probes were already at or near rendezvous. Could the others be detecting our radio interaction? That would require an amazing level of sensitivity. But then they did have that big grid, which might be good for more than deep frying bobs. And if they followed the direction of the probe's final transmission, that would explain